Today is Wednesday, November 29th, the year 2000. We're in Green Valley, Arizona. I'm Jeff Charnley, interviewing Dr. Philip Korth for the MSU Oral History Project for the sesquicentennial of the institution to be commemorated in the year 2005. As you can see, we've got our tape recorder today for this oral history. Dr. Korth, do you give us permission to do this interview?
I certainly do.
I'd like to start first with your personal and educational background. Before you went to college, where were you born and where did you grow up?
I was born in southern Minnesota, in Fairmont, Minnesota. We moved to another small town during the Second World War, and at the end of the war, 45, my dad got a job with 3M Company, and we moved to St. Paul. So I really grew up, insofar as I have ever grown up, in the Twin Cities. In St. Paul. I went to the University of Minnesota, started briefly in engineering, and then left the university after 1 year, probably shortly ahead of an invitation to leave, and went in the Army for 3 years, where I was trained and served as a linguist in the Czech language. Was stationed in Germany and returned to the university. That was in 1958. I got out of the Army, returned to the university, still kind of wandering around looking for a major, but finally decided on philosophy the last year I was there. Took all my philosophy courses for a major in 1 year, and which my wife says permanently disordered my mind. And so that was 1961. I got a bachelor's degree. I went to work for the American National Red Cross as an assistant field director. We trained at Fort Sill in Oklahoma. And then I was assigned down to Fort Bliss in El Paso. And I worked there for about a year and a half. I came home for Christmas vacation, and a friend of mine was in graduate school. I'd never thought of going to graduate school, but he had a reasonable job, so I explored that job advising, and I was making almost as much money advising as I was making for the Red Cross. And so I decided to apply for graduate school at the University of Minnesota in American Studies. I decided on that after talking to Mary Turpey, who was certainly the heart and probably the soul of the American Studies program at the University of Minnesota. I was still interested in going overseas, and that was partly what moved me in that direction. The Red Cross, of course, had posts at military posts all over the world, but it was fairly clear that I was going to be in El Paso longer than I wanted to be. And the American Studies program was an excellent preparation for the State Department. So that was my thinking when I went to the university. I've, of course, had taken very few American history courses and no American literature courses. So I had to audit some work, you know, to bring myself up to speed. So I began there in 1960. In the spring of 1963, began advising in the College of Liberal Arts the next fall.
Were you married at that time?
No, I wasn't. Mm-hmm. No, I wasn't. I met my wife that spring. I actually had known her since grade school, but we had gone separate paths. And I ran into her at the Mixers, the local graduate bar, just across the campus, and we were married in June of 1963. I continued to think in terms of the Foreign Service and made application, and I took the tests and succeeded, did very well on the tests, and so there was an interview, which I did well in. And then they came around to the campus and, you know, did the background checks. And I had been in the Army Security Agency, and I was in the Army, so I had a top secret clearance at that time. And so it wasn't much of a background check. But one of the people I talked to was my advisor, historian Hi Berman, labor history at Minnesota. And he told them, and subsequently told me, that he hoped I wouldn't get the job because he thought that that I should go into teaching. Well, that was really a new idea for me. Here I was, you know, a master's degree in a brand new area that I had not studied as an undergraduate, and here's this fellow saying I should be a professor. So I started thinking about that. And I still wasn't certain whether I wanted to do that, but it seemed like a nice option. And then he encouraged me to go on for a PhD. The State Department was not real happy with that, because I was on the verge of taking the physical, you know, for the appointment when I wrote them and said, well, I had continuing job as an advisor and I really wanted to complete a PhD. And the problem was at that time you had to have your appointment before you were 31, I believe. And I was approaching 31, and that was really why I wrote the letter. And they wrote back a real snippy letter, I thought. I said, well, if that's what you're going to do, you know, kind of forget it. And I was really kind of annoyed because they'd, you know, up until that point, every single bit of correspondence was flattering and encouraging, and how I was a highly selected, valuable candidate for this job, and then here I get a letter that says, buzz off. So then that kind of closed the door on the State Department, I decided. And so I went ahead and continued in my program. And then, lo and behold, the year I was just turning to turn 31, and I got a phone call one morning from Washington. I said, yeah, this is Phil Korth in Minneapolis. Well, it was the USIA. And they had a special program for highly recruited and selected candidates and all of this stuff, and they could give me a reserve appointment in the USIA. If I would agree to join them after I got a PhD. And I told them I was very pleased to know that getting a PhD did not disqualify me for the USIA. And so I agreed contingent upon that. I mean, they made the appointment, I accepted the appointment, but I said I would have to make a decision once I got the PhD. And they accepted that. So the last year in graduate school, I was fairly comfortable because I was assured of having a job mm-hmm. when I got out. But that must have been in 1960, early 1960 or 1966. That they called, must have been the fall of 1966, yes. So I had finished all my coursework that fall and was sorting around for a dissertation topic, and High Berman had really been a powerful influence on a subject area, especially was labor history. And I decided first that I would try to do something in labor history. And the industrial workers of the world interested me. They'd had an organization in Minneapolis, the Agricultural Workers Organization. And I was hoping to find some records. There were some good general books done on the IWW already. You know, they had been raided in the Palmer raids, and a lot of their records had disappeared, and so it was kind of a scramble to try and find materials. But in the course of looking over their record, what records I could find in Minnesota, I became more and more convinced this was not going to go anyplace. This was stillborn. There just wasn't enough material to develop a dissertation. But one of the organizations I found that they, with whom they negotiated, was the Nonpartisan League of North Dakota. Well, what was so interesting about that is that as a matter of philosophy and policy, the industrial workers of the world did not negotiate with owners. The owners and their ideas were usurpers, had no legitimacy, and you don't sit down and negotiate with the devil. The IWW tactic was to declare what their demands were, and when the employer met the demands, they'd go back to work. Mm-hmm. So here they were negotiating with this organization. Well, Nonpartisan League started to become interesting. And they had a lot of records. Minnesota Historical had all of their newspapers, a lot of correspondence. Arthur LeSueur, who was a prominent attorney in Minnesota, had been a major figure in the Nonpartisan League. Well, I won't give you the whole history of my dissertation, but but the materials were there. Farmers Alliance materials were in Lincoln, you know, so this was a lock. And so I had really started doing my research in probably November of 1966. And I took one trip to Lincoln, coordinated that with my daughter's birth, took my wife to the hospital in February, got on a plane and flew down to Lincoln, did about 3 days in the archives there, came back, picked up my wife and daughter from the hospital, and the nurses were very cool to me. Partly because there have been all my friends had come to visit her and they didn't know who the father was. And so here I showed up. You know, USOB. So I finished my dissertation in by early April and defended it in April, and so I had graduated I got the degree in June. So I wrote my dissertation in about 4 months.
Wow.
Which said it had kind of set a record at the American Studies program.
I could imagine
at that time.
4 years, I'm dying to
feel.
So what year was it then you graduated?
67.
67.
And that spring, while I was finishing the dissertation, I, of course, started going around to the markets. And it was a very good year. There were several colleges and universities interested in me, and Boston and Oregon State, and came down to Idaho State and Michigan State. And Idaho State was a history appointment. And I didn't know much about Pocatello. I actually didn't know much about East Lansing either, but Hi Berman, again my mentor, had taught at MSU in the ATL department.
Oh, really? Yeah.
For a year or two. And he knew Ben Strandness quite well. And so I went down there for, you know, to East Lansing for an interview, and Ben Strandness is a crafty bugger, you know. I stayed at Kellogg Center, and I got there late in the day, and we had dinner, and then he drove me around the campus at night. And here is this enormous campus, all lit up, you know. I mean, obviously world-class facility, and he smooth-talked me, and they made an offer before I left. And then I went back, and here was an offer from Idaho State. And so my wife and I had several conversations about that, and I really wasn't certain that I wanted to be a professor, even then. But I knew that the State Department was off. I wasn't going to do that. We had two little kids, and so we decided we'd go to East Lansing, and we'd give it 3 years. And see how, if that's what we wanted to do. Well, the 3 years turned into 32.
32.
So that's how I got to MSU. Yeah. Ben Strandness was crucial in all of that.
And sounds like Hi Berman was too.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. We're still in touch. He's still working. Yeah. Although I think he doesn't teach too much at Minnesota, but he's very active. He had a very strong political, left political background. Mm-hmm. And he really made a home in Minneapolis. He was the guy who introduced me to the Minneapolis Teamsters strike, which was, you know, I did an oral history and a book on that. Mm-hmm. He was an advisor to Hubert Humphrey and very active in the range, the Iron Range studies that Vicoli and included oral histories. So he was very, very fine man.
Well, oral history wasn't part of your dissertation, though.
No, it was not.
It wasn't at that time.
No.
What, when you first got to Michigan State, what do you recall about some of your impressions when you first got here?
Well, you know, one of the first things was, you know, going into a classroom with a spine that was alternately frozen and made out of jelly, you know. I mean, it was not a comfortable thing to walk into a classroom. I had taught classes at Minnesota, and I didn't teach a course, but I'd visited some American Studies classes and made presentations. And of course, in graduate studies, I'd made presentations on papers I'd written in literature courses and history courses and things of that sort, you know. But walking in knowing you had, well, 10 weeks, and it meant 4 times a week then, right? So you had 40 sessions that you had to fill up with something that was, you hoped was halfway intelligent and interesting, and the course at that time was designed by a faculty committee in the department. So the texts were chosen, the array, the syllabus was written. So you just kind of had to follow, you know, the program that was already laid out. So it didn't, there wasn't the anxiety of, you know, what am I going to do next so much in the sense of what document I'm going to choose. But it was, what am I going to do with all these people? You know? Now, I had a pretty good training at Minnesota, I thought. You know, but it wasn't as broad as was demanded in ATL. There were probably a third of the names in that syllabus that I had never heard about. You know, so I had to scramble around, you know, to find out who in God's name these people were and what did they do that was significant and how was I going to handle this in the classroom. So it was not comfortable. And then, of course, when I got this first set of papers, I looked at them, what the hell am I going to do with these? So there was some in, you know, there was some sort of in-service training. Bob Wright, I think, was in charge of that. And it was useful, you know, and it helped ease some of the anxiety. But it was, I was, after the first quarter there, I was still was not sure this is what I wanted to make a career out of, you know. On the other hand, I couldn't have asked for a more creative and dynamic and supportive faculty in any institution I would have gone to. I mean, ATL at that time had, I think, about 80 to 90 faculty, all PhDs, with an array of backgrounds and interests that was just stunning. I mean, from, you know, Al Thurman, whose major was speech, you know, to Perry Janakis, who was interested in millennialism and the late 19th century, and, you know, Bruce Curtis, who at that time was working in 19th century interests too, and so there were, and Bruce was my age, but Perry was significantly older, and Al Thurman was older. You know, so there was a spread of people, and one of the most interesting parts of the day was kind of your coffee break mid-morning, because you'd go into the lounge, and my God, there'd be conversations about everything. You know, you could just kind of pick and choose. And this included... this was a university college thing, so mainly ATL people were in the lounge there. But there were people from humanities who'd come up and have their coffee there too. You know, Bessie Hall was, in lots of ways, a very what a scholar would just love to have. You know, just a place to test ideas, to talk about the stuff you're teaching and learn different approaches from people in an informal way, which I think sticks better than a lot of the formal presentations you might have. So it, you know, the people, the faculty there really began to be a very important part of what I was interested in.
You mentioned Bruce Curtis. Were there any others that were a core that ultimately became your friends and colleagues? And not that everybody didn't, or
right. Well, yes, there were originally five of us. I wasn't terribly confident about my own writing and scholarship, and I liked the idea of kind of peer discussion and editing, and that's what it came to be called later. At that time, you just got together, you know, in a kind of bull session. And I put together a group, Bruce Curtis, Jim McClintock, Reed Baird, and Herb, his last name escapes me. He was only there briefly and then went back over to Grand Rapids. But there were five of us. And anytime anybody had something, a paper they were going to deliver, an article they wanted, a chapter, whatever, anytime we'd written something, we'd meet at somebody's house, and everybody would get it ahead of time, and then we'd have a critique. And it was relatively informal, you know, over wine and cheese usually, when some of us were still drinking a lot. It got kind of lively. But it was a wonderful way to learn the impact of what you've written. And I mean, it got pretty detailed at times. I mean, we got to discussing words, and not just structures, you know. So I think my writing improved significantly just because of that interaction. And they remain, you know, Jim and Bruce, I count among my best friends today. Reed, of course, died. Mm-hmm. Herb, you know, went back to Calvin College. So that was kind of a core group that, you know, we were mutually supportive and helpful that way.
How would you describe the mood on campus, the students, when you first arrived?
Well, I got there the year after the Orange Horse. Now, the Orange Horse was a sit-in in Bessie Hall in support of, I think, three or four faculty, ATL faculty, who had been fired. Bob Fogarty was, I met him, knew him, he was a fairly nice guy, went on to Amherst, I believe. And then there were two others, I don't remember the name because I didn't really meet them. The issue had been style, but it was a little more than that. I mean, they were in the view of the department leadership, they were using inappropriate language, a lot of sexual references, things that were not so much politically controversial, but remember, this is the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, sexual liberation and all of that. And, you know, Ben Strandis and Bern Engel and some of the older guys in charge were pretty uncomfortable with that. And, of course, it generated controversy. I mean, the kids would go home and tell their parents that this guy had used certain four-letter words in class, and it came back to the university. John Hanna was still president at that time. And if it came back to John Hanna, you know, it came down to the department. And so there was some discomfort about them. They were untenured, so it was a matter of not renewing their contracts. And they were very popular teachers. This happened just after I had had my interview there, so I really didn't know too much about it. The other thing that was in the wind was the Ramparts article on MSU's involvement in Vietnam and our training of GM's police. So there were several sort of controversies on campus that way when I got there. And of course the war was, you know, grinding on in Vietnam. There was more and more concern about that and opposition to it being expressed around on campus. There was also talk of collective bargaining for faculty. And of course that, my ears perked up for that because, you know, labor history had been a major interest of mine. But I'm, you know, I'm a new, wet behind the ears assistant professor coming in on campus, and I'm still trying to find my way around, you know, and not quite certain the way things worked, you know. And then I was elected, you know, well, first I was chosen to be on the university symposium committee, which that was a University College symposium committee. That was a big deal. Ed Collins, big deal. We'd bring in well-known figures to discuss some particular topic. And this was to be in 1968. No, this was in the spring of 68, I believe. So this happened really quickly after I got there. I was appointed to this committee. And we decided on the topic, the city, and we had Saul Alinsky. I was insisted that he be one of them. Eric McKittrick, some of these names escape me. One, an editor of an architectural magazine, and a theologian to come in and talk about the city. And it was quite successful. And I was delighted to meet Saul Alinsky, who was just a wonderful person. You know, we had, although I, when I met him, he had flown into Detroit, and he was expecting to stay overnight there. Well, his secretary had arranged with us that he would come to an informal session that night over in Justin Morrill. And so there's some communication mix-up on their part. And I didn't go down to meet him at the airport, but I was going to meet him when he got to Justin Morrill. So I came there and I had his itinerary, you know, paper.